Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to another season of the Stir Crazy Podcast. As always, I'm Rob Nelson.
And I'm Mike Bakov in season five. This is still going. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, five seasons in 1 year. I think it's a year to the day since we got going with this.
Yeah, since the pandemic kind of pushed us into podcasting territory, and we want to thank everybody for sticking with us and listening to the podcast as we've kind of gotten better at it. And I think we have a really good season, these next set of episodes, and a really good topic to start off on.
Yeah, we are going to be off to the races, as it were, with eight episodes this season. We're going to talk about everything from prohibition to horse racing, as I just joked about. And we're going to even dig into a little bit of cryptozoology and tackle the popular subject of Bigfoot.
Yeah, that will be a very interesting topic. I'm interested to see where we head. But we're going to start off watching the ponies, where we're going to talk about horse racing as the Kentucky Derby is this weekend.
Yeah.
And sound like a good place to not just talk about the history of horse racing, but also touch on some of the local stuff, because we have a very rich history of horse racing here in Hall County.
Absolutely. Mike and I had the pleasure to head out to Fauner Park here in Grand Island and speak with the CEO of Fauner Park, actually, Chris Katulak. We had a great conversation. He brought us up to speed on all the terminology and the, you know, sort of the culture of the sport itself. And it was a really good time. And I think you can hear that in the conversation we had.
All right. So I think it will behoove us to get started.
Oh, God. And with that, we're going to get going with another season of the Stir Crazy Podcast. Hello again, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I'm Rob Nelson, and I'm joined today by a couple people here at the Stir Museum family. Mike Bakoven, who you may remember from the intros and outros of the Stir Crazy Podcast.
Yeah, 30 seconds ago. There we were.
Yeah, there we go. And Sam Kozda from the Stir Museum Foundation is making another appearance.
Hello.
Thanks for being
in this audio medium.
He's not the best color man in the league for nothing, folks. Anyway, so today we're going to be talking about something I think that is interesting to all of us, and that is the history of horse racing. Grand Island has a history within that sport as well, with our own Fauner Park, and later in the episode we're going to be traveling out to that location and speaking with somebody familiar with the sport who works at that location. But first things first, we are going to delve into the history behind the scenes of horse racing, and I think the three of us are the people to do it.
Well, give it a shot, if nothing else. You know, maybe 5-1 we can pull this off. 10-1, I don't know.
Those are some pretty good odds, Mike.
I'll take it. So, not being the history guy and making that a caveat for everything that we're going to be talking about, man, horse racing has been around a long time. It's like people showed up and the European settlers showed up, built communities, and shortly after there came the ponies.
Yeah, essentially, I'd say as long as there have been domesticated horses, there have been horse races, horse racing, with chariots, without chariots, saddles, no saddles, that kind of stuff, long races, short races.
Yeah, chariots, that's a really interesting thing I hadn't really thought about, because I was looking at American horse racing and, you know, the image that everybody has with the jockey and the horse with the number along the side. But yeah, chariots, man, it goes way, way back.
Yeah, we're talking Greek Empire, Roman Empire. That's the length of time that we go back, and you find stories of horse racing and spectators and being involved in said events. I don't know that they had the great names that we've come into contact with in more recent years, but yeah, definitely it's been around.
I want to get to horse names in case you guys know anything about that, because I've always been curious about like how horse names come about, but we'll get there. But yeah, doing a little bit of research on this, Library of Congress and places in there, it looks like that organized horse racing kind of started with the jockeys all the way back like prior to 1800, like we're talking 1750 in there is kind of when American horse racing kind of first became a thing, because there was an establishment of something called the Jockey Club, which was basically the governing body for horse racing, the thing that set forth the regulations and the standards and everything that you would need in order for the sport to take place. And the thing that blows my mind about that is like not just, okay, so we're creating these, you know, these rules and these standards, but then how do you disseminate them? How do you enforce them? How do you get them out to everywhere so that, you know, in the 1800s you can have, horse racing basically in most of the country, most of the, you know, country where there were large population centers to watch it and to do other things.
Yeah, I'd say, like, as anything else, nothing really happens overnight. Mm-hmm. You see, kind of starting in the early 18th century during the reign of Queen Anne, actually, in England, this horse racing, kind of as we would recognize it anyway, begins to become popular and sort of a professionalized sport. But like you said, there's not a lot of regulation. It becomes sort of corrupt. There's a lot of, you know, there's that good old gambling that we're talking about. And that's kind of where you see the jockey club things coming in to kind of give it some legitimacy and a structure around it, which I think that starts in around 1750. So yeah, from there, I mean, you just see the evolution of the sport become more and more modernized.
Yeah, we're going to jump around the timeline a little bit, but one of the things I found was really interesting too, is that horse racing got really popular and then there was a big backlash to it. So you have this thing where a lot of horse tracks are just, you know, packed to the gills and people are loving this sport. And then in the timeline of the podcast, we're going to do prohibition next week, but we were talking about that. And it seems like whenever, you know, something kind of crests, then another force comes to pull it back. And that seems to be what happened with horse racing, is that it was such a big deal that there was an organized group that came in and said, this cannot stand, or we don't agree with this from a values standpoint, or any of the number of things. But it looked like roundabout, you know, prior to World War I, there was a pretty heavy crackdown on these sorts of things.
Yeah. And another part of it, as to like when you come to like the Triple Crown races and stuff, there's an ebb and flow again, following a lot of success with Triple Crown winners. Mm-hmm. You go from Citation, who I think wins a Triple Crown in 1948. And then there's this a significant reduction in the amount of like attendance and people who are interested in it, because there's not a another Triple Crown winner until Secretariat in 1973. So 25 years later, and he, you know, that horse comes along and he's a new generation. He's on the cover of every major magazine. He's Horse of the Year. He's on, I think, Time, Newsweek, Sports Illustrated. He's, you know, a pop culture icon even. There's movies made after him. But Seattle Slough comes, Affirmed comes in the 70s. But then again, you see this kind of die off again in the 80s and the 90s, because again, there's not a Triple Crown winner until American Pharoah, who comes along in 2015. Now we had American Pharoah, and then Justify came along a couple years later. And, you know, the 1st of May is coming up. First Saturday in May, Kentucky Derby. Maybe we'll have another one. Who knows?
Yeah. Hey, I don't know. But it seems to me like you were talking about the Triple Crown, and Sam can jump in on this. The Triple Crown seemed to be like the conduit from which horse racing became popular. You know, it's like that there were horse races around, there were people, you know, there were tracks, there was betting, there was everything that went around with it. But then the Triple Crown was the thing that really seized the American imagination.
A lot of people may not know, for your casual observers, that the Triple Crown that we have is not the only Triple Crown series.
Oh, I did not know that.
It actually, there's a Triple Crown in Britain that's actually kind of more, it's thought of to be as more difficult because the races are actually a bit longer. There's a 1 mile that's called the 2000 Guineas, a 1.5 mile in their Derby, and a 1.7 mile in the St. Ledger Stakes. In the American Triple Crown series, I believe they're a mile and an eighth, a mile and a quarter, and a mile and a half. So they're just a tad longer in some of these. So I think, and they've been around a significantly longer amount of time. Like, these races in Britain date back to the 1770s, whereas in America, the Triple Crown series is mid-19th century, mm-hmm. Last quarter of the 19th century is when those begin.
Yeah, that history, even when you go out to Fawner Park here in Grand Island, I love there, and of course, I've lived in Grand Island for 20 years, so I've been to Fawner Park a bunch, and they have those glass cases out front where you can get a sense of not just like that history and that it stretches back to, you know, to the town, but going all the way back, they have images of what Grand Island looked like, and it's, you know, just it's something that had been around and been big for a very long time, which I always found was really interesting. Also, just because I like throwing this out there, if you ever go to Fawner Park before they do the major renovations, they have the photo of a three-way photo finish. Have you seen that photo at Fawner Park? Where three horses made it to the point where a winner could not be distinguished. And that photo is just like, boom, you know, blows your mind. It's like, well, okay, that would have been a heck of a race to see.
if you were gambling and you had some money on those horses, that's not the way.
That would make you very unhappy.
Well, what's the one where you pick the first, second, and third? There's like a term for that. Like, it's not trifecta, but like you pick them to finish or something.
Are you talking about win, place, show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have your winner is your win, and then place is first or second, and then you have your show, which the horse can come in first, second, or third. So, I mean, I guess if you put all three of those horses to show, maybe then you were, win, I should say, then maybe it did pay out pretty well.
Well, I wonder what the odds would be to that type of thing happening. And I think they actually have it in the photo credit, you know, next to the photo saying this never happens. You know, it's like this was a 20 million to 1 sort of odds. And I'm like, it'd be like lightning hitting a, you know, lottery winner or something. And that's pretty awesome when something like that not only happens, but happens in a sport so regimented where they're taking photos of the finishes and they're doing all the important things that you need to do in order for, you know, horse racing to be on the up and up.
Yeah. And, I'm kind of a nerd of the Triple Crown series myself. Mm-hmm. And I just like kind of looking back through old YouTube races, which I do occasionally, I'm not going to remember which year, but it was either 89 or 90. And the horse's name was either Silver Charm or Touch Gold.
Good names.
One was in one year, one was in another, but there was a photo finish in the last race of the Triple Crown series. And the horse lost the Triple Crown by literally 2 inches. And there's a photo finish of a nose finish. And it's just like the most devastating loss you could possibly imagine.
Well, basically those photo finishes can end in what's called a dead heat, which is where they cannot decide which one is the winner. And Fawner Park actually had a dead heat this season. So
really?
They did. Mm-hmm. I will mention one of the horses' names, I believe, was Go-Go Sam Go. So here's
how
Sam.
How could you not bet on Go-Go Sam Go? Come on.
Exactly.
Yeah. What were the odds of Go-Go Sam Go?
I would have to look it up, but I will say that if there's a horse named Sam, Sam is out there betting on it. So
fair enough.
Good to know. Well, that's the other thing too, is that we just, again, not being the history guy, but just kind of doing the cursory research, is that not only did like horse racing become a thing in the United States, and there were, you know, hundreds of racetracks across the country before the bust kind of came, when the boom was going, there were hundreds of them, but culture is kind of surrounded. It started to grow around these things. So not just, you know, when you think of the Kentucky Derby, you think of big hats and mint juleps, right? When you think of, you know, or you could think of Guys and Dolls or any of the other, you know, ways that this has had some sort of cultural impact where it's like, oh, we're going to go watch the ponies, you know, that sort of thing. And I kind of love thinking about that from a cultural standpoint almost as much as a historical one.
No, I'm fascinated by especially the culture of some of those traditions of the Kentucky Derby. The mint julep is
not a great drink. It's not a great drink.
However, the race is in Kentucky, which is the home of bourbon.
Yeah.
The mint julep is a bourbon drink. The mint julep is a sign of the South. It's a staple of Southern culture. So it makes sense that this Kentucky beverage and this, you know, Southern, you know, image would be the drink of choice. As for the hats, I looked into this once, and so the proprietor of Churchill Downs, which is the track, was owned at one time by Meriwether Lewis Clark Jr., the grandson of the famous explorer.
I did not know that.
And the sport at the time that he was in charge of it had become kind of like seedy and a little bit less respectable. So he launched a PR campaign to, you know, kind of gussy up the place. And he encouraged high fashion, very high profile people to attend and come hats and black tie and coattails, as they say, or is it white tie and coattail?
So it was trying to put a sheen of like a veneer of respectability.
Exactly.
On a place that had lost that sheen.
And as a result, it has become this kind of very high fashion, high class celebrity stop along the way. And I don't think that that's changing either. I mean, yes, they sing Old Kentucky Home still, but they also now, you know, like some of these other places like the Belmont Stakes, which is the last one, they sing New York, New York, because it's in New York. But that's only a, you know, 30-year tradition that since Sinatra came out with that song or whatever. So, I mean, I think it's the whole sport is evolving those traditions even today.
Well, and I think that's one of my favorite parts of horse racing.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what's it like now? Yeah,
yeah, is it's just such a social event for people. I mean, even if you have no knowledge of horse racing or, you know, no experience in the gambling aspect of it, there is a social part of the culture of horse racing that it just feels, you can have a really good time with your friends and family, and it's just a really good time.
Well, and it's, I think Rhode Island is fortunate and rare for a community of our size to have a place like Fauner Park. I mean, Exarban in Omaha used to do horse racing once upon a time, and they closed down. You know, I mean, it's the sort of thing where the fact that it's still alive in its current iteration, and you and I and, you know, everyone can go and throw down a little bet on the horses and see the, you know, see what is basically, this isn't low level racing. I mean, you know, there's some horses doing some great things out there, and then, you know, do it with the family and just have everybody out. That's special. I think that's great that it's in our community.
Well, and the good thing about Fauner Park is it's not intimidating. I mean, I personally would be very intimidated to go to the Kentucky Derby, and there's something welcoming about small town, you know, Fauner Park, but it has fun, and you can put a $2 bet on a horse and you're not going to break the bank. But I know there are people out there at Fauner that are putting a little bit more than $2 down on those horses too. So just like I said before, it's just, I bet about anybody could have fun at the horse races.
Well, and Sam, I'd kind of just like, I'd say right there that sense of approachability expands, I think, to the state of Nebraska and this sport as well. Omaha and the Exarban track, Mike, has a connection to the Triple Crown lore itself, in that we were for 9 years the final location of the Triple Crown winner Omaha in the 1930s, I believe. He won in 1935. He was the third Triple Crown winner, the horse named Omaha. He had no connection with the state of Nebraska, actually, but kind of speaking to that approachability of Nebraska, William Woodward, who was the owner of Omaha, was from New York. The horse was raised in Kentucky at Claiborne Farms. And but he said of Nebraska and Omaha specifically that it was one of the best towns in these United States. And after he was all done breeding, and he was out to pasture, as it were, and done with his racing career, he spent the last 9 years of his life in Omaha. And he was kind of at PR publicity events at the Exarban racetrack in Omaha. And it was just, you know, people came out who are fans of the sport and saw this legendary horse.
Well, and like you said, Rob, I think there is a sense of pride Nebraskans hold. And in present day, there are quite a few horses out there that are Nebraska born and bred and trained, actually. So if you look at the modern day programs, you will see stars that denote that they're from Nebraska. And I just think that's something that even us in Grand Island are proud of, to see Nebraska born and raised horses moving on to these bigger races than Fauner.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Sam, you said that if you were like to go to the to one of the Triple Crown races, it might be a little intimidating. What about it like intimidates you? Are there any traditions there that you'd be like, I don't want any part of that, or my hat's not big enough, or what would be the?
I guess I wouldn't want to be stared at for not knowing the lyrics to Old
Kentucky Home.
Yep. See, there you go. I'm already intimidated. I didn't even know the name of the song.
Well, it's probably okay that you wouldn't want to sing that song. There's actually a pretty problematic history with that song, and then, you know, it dates back to the 1850s, actually. Okay, so the song is by Stephen Foster, and it originates in the 1850s, and he kind of wrote it in response to the book by Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the song is actually kind of rooted in on the behalf of an enslaved person who is longing for the family that they've been ripped apart from and sold away from.
Ooh,
and that's the old Kentucky home that they are referencing in this song. Although the first verse is the one that's typically sung with the refrain of "the sun shines bright in this old Kentucky home." There are,
which is the part people know that, and people like.
And everyone, and you know, and it's the state, it was for a while the state song of Kentucky. And like, that's, you know, it sounds very gorgeous, wistful, and beautiful and wistful and southern and all that stuff. But there's other stanzas of the song that are, you know, very, very dark. And one of such is, a few more days for to tote the weary load. No matter, 'twill never be light. A few more days till we totter on the road. Then my old Kentucky home, good night. Which kind of just...
I'm going to work till I die.
Yeah, it's bleak.
And that's pretty bleak.
But, you know, big hats and frills and a mint julep. Yeah, we'll just sing the first verse and it'll be okay and we don't have to think about it.
Well, I mean, you go back to the idea of like, I can see if you only knew that first verse or you only had those positive associations with that first verse. But then, yeah, at some point you've got to reckon with everything else that's happening there. And I think that's a metaphor for horse racing as a whole, you know, because we've talked about it is fantastic to go to the horse races and spend a great afternoon out there. And we encourage people to do it. But there've been all sorts of reports in the past couple of years about, you know, horses not being treated terribly well. And, you know, all that sort of thing. There was a famous case a couple of years ago about a guy who in the upper echelon of horse racing circles could come out and kill your horse and make it look like an accident. You know, I mean, like those sorts of stories are out there. And so, I think that's always been part of the reputation of horse racing is that it's got this dark underbelly, but at the same time, it's like, there are a lot of good, hardworking people doing a lot of good, you know, a lot of good work. And I think that's great.
Yeah. And just like anything else, I mean, there's the dark past or whatever, but like with a sport like horse racing, that's literally as old as time, you know, and a sport that embraces history, I would definitely welcome, as somebody who's interested in 19th century history, just kind of a revisiting of some of those, you know, less favorable traditions and, you know, taking advantage of those and, you know, in the era that we're currently in, and it's definitely the climate to do that. And you'd be welcomed, I think, by a new generation of would-be horse race fan enthusiasts, for those, you know, corrections.
Yeah.
Well, and now I think those horses are treated better than,
yeah,
you know, those horses are fed better than I am. So
yeah, that's true.
I know modern day veterinary medicine and everything, those horses are taken really good care of.
Yep.
And
that's when you just here in Grand Island, the way Farner Park's laid out, you can drive by and see the horses, you know, walking around and having their lunch and, you know, hooked to the training stuff before, you know, and it's all out in the open. So, I mean, that's great. And yeah, Farner Park looks like it's running a great operation. So.
Absolutely.
So going back to like the cultural side of things, I love that they've made a couple really great horse racing movies, you know, aside from like The Sting and, you know, the ones that focus on the gambling side, they've done a couple that like focus on the horses. So you've got like a Secretariat movie that Disney did like 5-10 years ago. You've got that Tobey Maguire Seabiscuit movie from like 15 years ago. So do you have like a favorite racehorse in history, anything like that, Sam?
I can't pick a favorite horse. I mean, I love horses in general, but it kind of goes back to the creativity and adventurousness behind the names of these horses.
I want to talk about the names. I don't know how they get those.
Kind of referencing Go Go Sam Go. I mean, how fun is that? But you have the stealthy names of American Pharaoh, and then you have
Gallant Fox, Whirl Away, Count Fleet, Sir Barton.
Oh, those kinds of...
Okay, Rob, take it
those
out.
Those are great names.
No, I think I can shed some light on how. I don't exactly know how the names are chosen. I know it's not as simple as your name's Ben, and then we get to call you Ben. But I do know that, at least in the Triple Crown circles, that there is a submission process. The name has to involve both the patrilineal and matrilineal sides. Mm-hmm. So there has to be like a reference to both of them in the name. So like, for instance, oh man, this is going to test me. Secretariat's name. They didn't actually call him Secretariat. They called him Big Red his whole life. Like, but like his official name for the races was Secretariat. But his parents' names were something Royal and Bold Ruler. And from that, they got the name Secretariat somehow. And that's all I can say.
Huh.
But somewhere in there, there was, I think they had 7, 8, 9 names that they came up with that they submitted, and most of them were rejected. I think there's some kind of governing board within the sport that decides what you can be. I don't know how you can arrive at something like Smarty Jones or California Chrome or I'll Have Another without some kind of submission process, though.
Right. I imagine it gets more strict the higher up you go. So if somebody, you know, wants to name a horse Go Go Sam Go, they can do that, but it's not going to be, you know, probably running in the Preakness.
Yeah. And with that said, though, I think there's something to, this is based on no statistical evidence at all. But for some reason, I feel like every one of the Triple Crown winners has a name that just says, I'm the best at this sport. Yeah. Like literally everyone. I mean, there are names like Assault, for instance.
That's a great name for a horse.
War Admiral is another one. I mean, Affirmed is great. American Pharaoh commands.
Yeah.
Secretariat's a great name. Seattle Slough is a great name. I mean, these are just, you know, you hear it and you're like, yeah, that's.
It's got
like
to have
a ring
to it, I think. Yeah.
And that's why I was kind of captivated by a California Chrome a few years ago, because I thought that was, oh, that's the name. That's going to be the one to do it. And then he didn't. But the next year, American Pharaoh won. So there you go.
Yep.
Who knows?
All right. So maybe we close it out with just our favorite part of the sport of horse racing. Like, what is it that captures your imagination about this sport? For me, it's the noise. 60 hooves hitting the dirt at the same time. That is a distinct noise. You know what that noise is. And it's like you hear it and it immediately conjures exactly what's happening. And there aren't a whole lot of noises like that.
Yeah, I would agree. Kind of with the noise, just, I mean, I'm a big sports fan. I love going to Memorial Stadium on Husker football games and listening to that roar of the crowd. And it's very similar here locally at Fawner Park. When those horses are on the home stretch, I mean, you don't have a quiet soul in the grandstands or anywhere. Everyone's cheering either for their horse to hurry up or for their horse to keep the lead. But just the culture of horse racing and togetherness. So kind of the same as you, Mike.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I would first, I'd just like to say to your both of your points, I think that what's unique about the noise in horse racing is that like everybody's in it together in a way that, you know, if you go to a Cubs or a Cardinals game in baseball or a Lakers game or something in basketball, you definitely have like a section of fans that are rooting for your team to lose. But if you're at like a Triple Crown race and, you know, everybody, 100,000 plus people are going for this horse, and you can high five the guy or girl next to you and know that we're on the same team here.
That is super cool.
And I just think that's really unique. What my favorite part of the sport of horse racing, though, is probably the stories that I make up in my mind about the lineages. I think it's like my version of like nerding out on royalty. I'm not a royal wedding fan at all, but I am super romantic about horse racing lineage for some reason. So like a lot of people may not know this, but Secretariat has a son that almost also won the Triple Crown and a grandson that almost won the Triple Crown. The son's name was Risen Star. And
great name.
Yeah, and it, again, homage to the great Secretariat. Mm-hmm. Okay, so backstory here. Secretariat wins the Belmont Stakes, and he ran it with a time of 2 minutes and 24 seconds, which is still the track record today. Heck of a lot years later, 50 years later.
Yeah,
Okay,
I don't know too many sports statistics that have held up that long.
Yeah, in 1988, Risen Star, who was his son, comes along, and he lost the Kentucky Derby slightly, then won the Preakness. And then in the third race, the Triple Crown was out of the question, but in the home stretch of the Belmont, he ran away famously, just almost as impressively as Secretariat did.
Oh,
in that, you know, that famous scene, I think that everybody's kind of seen of him winning by 31 lengths and it's not even close and that sort of thing. But he has this similar style win. And he finishes with a time of 2 minutes and 26 seconds, which is the second fastest of all time. And like that, so it's still the second fastest of all time. So father and son doing that. And
that's
then
cool.
Fast forward to 2006, I believe, which was the first race that I ever watched in horse racing. And it was when Smarty Jones was going for the Triple Crown. And he won the first two races. And he was the grandson of Secretariat. And there hadn't been a Triple Crown winner in 26 years.
Yep.
And he's coming down the backstretch. And you think he's going to win. And he's like, you know, he's got a 4-length lead at the top of the stretch and you're like, he's going to run away. And then in the last like few seconds, Birdstone passes him right at the end and he loses. And it was heartbreaking. And that was my introduction to horse racing.
Heartbreak.
As you can tell probably from the tone of my voice, I'm a little bit passionate about this aspect of it, but yeah, that's my favorite part.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, we're going to be watching the Kentucky Derby here this weekend, and man,
yes.
Bring it on. This will be fun.
The first Saturday in May is coming. All right. We can pause it there for segment one of the horse racing podcast. We're going to step away for a few words, and when we are back, we're going to head out to Fawner Park and be speaking with Chris Kutuwak, the CEO of Fawner Park here in Grand Island. So we'll be right back. Stick with us.
Today's podcast is brought to you by A.J. Sousa Shoe Shop, located on South Front Street in Railroad Town, Nebraska. If you want fine dress shoes made to the latest styles, don't miss inspecting our stock. Shoes remade to fit your needs at prices most reasonable for your purse. Remember, Sousa Shoes in Railroad Town.
And we are back with more of the Stir Crazy podcast. I am joined today with Chris Kutuwak of Fawner Park, the CEO here over at Fawner Park. And we're going to talk a little bit about horse racing today. Chris, thanks for being on the show.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Just kind of want to jump right in and ask you about your background in the sport of horse racing. How does someone kind of come to be the CEO of Fawner Park?
Yeah. Fate, destiny, bad luck, good luck.
Yeah.
The first go-around for me here at Fawner Park in Grand Island was from 1986 to 1995. I was the track announcer here.
Oh, wow.
So this is my second tour of duty, if you will. But I became a track announcer after I fell in love with horse racing in Omaha. I grew up in Omaha, and I was just an easy bike ride to get to the former racetrack known as Exarban.
Sure.
Nebraska spelled backwards. And I trained myself to be an announcer by going up into the grandstand and tying an old cassette. It wasn't quite a Walkman yet. We didn't have those back in the early 80s, or at least I didn't. And I'd tie it around my neck with some old ice skating skate laces, and I would call races into this tape recorder and just critique myself. And once in every 50 race calls, I'd get maybe one that was halfway decent, and that would go on a resume tape, and kind of kept that. So I bombarded Hugh Miner, the then general manager here at Fawner Park, for a couple of years with my tapes. And ultimately, I got to visit with him in his office, and he said, I'm not going to hire you now, but I will tell you to keep up the good work, and maybe there's something for you down the road.
That's a great story. I've always been fascinated with announcers and how they just seem to make it look so or sound so easy, especially with those names. I mean, I can't imagine like trying to keep the jockey straight, the horses straight, and then like calling what place they're in from, I'm assuming, a few hundred yards away.
We're all a different breed, just like goalies are in hockey. It takes a different sort for that. But, you know, it's easier because I fell in love with the sport. There are some announcers that I would consider surgeons because they are so refined in what they say and how they say it, and they never stumble over their words. I was never one of those guys, but I sure loved horse racing, and it was my portal to get me to where I am right now.
Well, you mentioned breeds. That's always a topic in horse racing I've been interested in personally. I know there's only one Triple Crown horse winner that's been the son of a Triple Crown horse winner, which is Omaha, ironically. Mm-hmm. Is there more that goes into it besides, you know, people just kind of looking at what horses have had success in the past? And can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, by all means, pedigree. You know, there's an expression I learned in one of my travels to South America in Chile, and it's in Spanish. It's que es en el gato también es en los gatitos, which is what is in the cat is also in the kittens. So there's, you know, there's the pedigree. And you have to have a pedigree to give you an edge, but then you also have to be a horse who's in the care of a horseman who really knows what's going on, because that's the person that's going to say, hey, I need to ask a little more of the horse in this regard, or I need to back off. This horse maybe needs some rest or something, or this horse is showing me something by doing something. And that's where, you know, you separate the wheat from the chaff as far as who's going to become a good horseman and who is not.
Yeah. Where does the jockey play into that picture?
That's a good question. I would say a good jockey helps an ordinary horse, and an ordinary jockey might hurt a good horse. How about that? It's important, but if you have a really good horse, you just kind of have to steer it around there and stay out of its way and keep it out of others getting in its way. But it's important. I wouldn't say it's, to me, I think it's the trainer more than the jockey.
Really? So like Bob Baffert might have more of a say on that than Victor Espinoza or something at the top level.
That's a good point.
Not that I know anything about what I'm talking about.
But. You're coming with those names. And you know, closer to home, of course, the Vanberg family.
Sure.
Marion Vanberg, a national Hall of Famer, and his son Jack Vanberg, both national in the National Museum of Racing Hall of Fame, and in, of course, the Nebraska Horse Racing Hall of Fame also.
So in terms of like the jockey schedule itself, I know I'm kind of a novice in the sport in terms of the nitty gritty details of it. I watch all the races just like anybody else does, but like what's going on behind the scenes is a lot more to kind of be aware of. I stumbled across the name Armando Martinez, and he's considered to be one of Fauna Park's top jockeys. Is that correct?
Yes.
What is like a typical schedule for a jockey? Is he or she on a number of horses? Are they running a lot of races in a year, or is it more they're on one horse? Or
yeah, no, another good question. Jockeys typically will show up to the racetrack in the morning, each morning, and go from barn to barn to breeze horses in the morning. That's a form of training, not gallop horses. That's where you have gallop boys, exercise riders. They do that. But if a trainer's ready to have his horse blow it out and go a little, you know, faster than just a simple jog or a canter or a gallop, they'll get a jockey. And potentially this jockey that would breeze the horse in the morning at no charge would then, it's like a quid pro quo. Hey, I breezed your horse on Thursday. That means I hope that next week I'll be able to ride this horse in a race. And every jockey has an agent, and an agent might have two or three jockeys, but that helps the rider get on what we'll call live mounts, get on the good horses to ride.
Okay.
So it could be as simple as good jockeys ride good horses. And what I'll tell beginners is look through the program, look at the trainer who has the best win percentage and the jockey has the best win percentage or the best among the group there. And those are your best chances to look at it that way.
You're throwing out a lot of words like breezed and, you know, things like that. And there's a lingo all its own. A few of the phrases I wanted to ask you about were furlongs and hands.
Yep.
I think that that's really cool, but I don't necessarily know how to measure a furlong.
Sure. Antiquated, to be for sure. Even a rod, and a rod is something I'll explain also. But a breeze, by the way, is when a horse goes three-quarter speed, maybe a little faster than three-quarter speed, maybe 7/8 speed.
Okay.
And so you might see that or hear that as terminology. Yeah, we breezed this horse a half mile to get him ready for today's race. That would be the context that you would use.
I see.
That. Yeah. Okay. A hand is a unit of measure. If you were to hold your hand out, if you were shaking someone, the distance from the bottom of your palm to the top, maybe that's 4 inches, 4.5 inches. So years ago, and even now, modern day, people measure horses. Oh, that horse is 14 hands, or that horse is 15 hands. A tall thoroughbred would be 16. Anything over 16 hands, you're getting into a larger size horse there. A furlong is 220 yards, or 2 football fields.
Sure.
It's also 1/8 of a mile. So 8 furlongs go into 1 mile. Now, I'll push your racetrack math even more. Fauna Park has a 5/8 mile racetrack. We're 5 furlongs. So in order to run a mile, which is 8 furlongs, you've got to make a complete lap and then some.
And then 3 more.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why when we have mile races, they start in the backstretch. And they run 3 furlongs before they get to the finish line the first time. Then they make another circuit, which is 5 furlongs. 3 + 5 = 8. There's your 8 furlongs.
Gotcha. And then you add it even further to something like the Bosselman Fauner Stakes, which is mile 16.
Yes. So there's a half a furlong. You look out at the racetrack, there are marker poles. The black and white poles are 16th of a mile, which is 110 yards. The green and white poles are a furlong pole. So in between each green and white pole, there would be a red and white pole, which is a quarter pole. And anyway, it all adds.
No. Hey, yeah. I get that part of it at least. Cause you can listen into the Triple Crown or the Breeders Cup and those kind of things. And they have those announcements. So at least I can follow that much.
And a rod, that's way old. That's 660 feet, which also equates to 220 yards. So a rod is a furlong.
Okay. Are there, I mentioned that the Bosselman Fauner, are there special traditions that are associated with that race in particular as it being the biggest race of the year?
The biggest tradition, I think, is we race here at Fauner Park with something called standard colors. So every time the horse is out on the racetrack on an ordinary day, the jockey silks, which are the jacket or jersey that they wear, the silks, no longer made out of silk, it's more of a, like a windbreaker material. Those coordinate to the post position. So the one is always red, the two is white, the three is blue, the four is yellow, five is green, so on and so forth. And we have corresponding saddle cloth. That's the numbers of that the horse is in the race. It's underneath the saddle. You'll see the red is one, the two is white, and so on and so forth. Well, for the Bosselman, we run under owners and trainers colors, which means the horse wears the silks that their owner would wear if they were racing at another racetrack that didn't have these standard colors. Very few tracks have standard colors anymore. It's great for the race fans because they know, where's the seven? Well, you know, the seven is, well, the seven used to be purple back in my day. Now the seven is, and now the purple is 10. The seven is now, is orange. Anyway, they would know, let's keep it simple. They see a rider with red silks, that's the number one horse, they know where it is.
Okay.
So the tradition is they get to wear the silks to the owners and trainers. That's why when you see a photo of the Bosselman on the front page of the Independent newspaper and the rider's wearing silks that are different, the six horse won this year. He should have been in six in black silks. Instead, he was in some colorful blue and yellow silks.
Well, that's great. I was going to ask you about, you know, if you're running 5/8 or a mile and a 16th and they're, you know, having to go more than a lap and kind of circle back to it. Is there a track record then for the course for a mile or for 5/8?
Yeah. There at each distance that we race here at Fawner, whether it's 4 furlongs, 6 furlongs, 6.5 furlongs, mile, there's a track record. And if you look in the program, you'll see what that track record is. So, and we have a variety of distances because horses, just like humans, you know, when you go to a track meet there, you know that a miler or a long distance runner looks a lot different than what a sprinter looks like, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Same thing with horses. In horse racing, the thoroughbreds are sort of the middle distance and distance horses. The quarter horses, which we do not race here at Fawner Park, are the shorter, stocky, big engine room, you know, big hind end, built for speed. Those horses race 300 yards. That's their average distance.
Wow.
Whereby quarter horses race, you know, 3/4 of a mile average.
What is I'm not familiar, I guess, with the customs of each of the races at Fawner Park, but is it typically 3-year-olds? Is it typically, you know, 3 and up, 6 and under, or something like that?
Because of the time of the year we run at Fawner, it's usually older horses. And in horse racing, an older horse is a 4-year-old and up. You've asked a good question because in horse racing, horses turn a year old January 1st of each year. Okay. Even though, let's say they were born actually in February, as far as racing goes to determine their eligibility, we had to have a uniform date. And so that's January 1st. They do it that way in some other disciplines as well. But in horse racing, for sure, it's January 1st. So the soonest horses race are at age 2. Now, to race a horse at 8 when it's a 2-year-old, early on in the spring, it's still young. It's like a 10-year-old child. And we've seen athletes, you know, at 10,
sure.
We've seen Olympians, you know, very young that perform exceptionally well. And you get that with some 2-year-olds. But for me personally, I think it's too soon to start on horses. And so we don't write races for 2-year-olds at Fawner Park because our meet ends the end of April, first part of May. So we wouldn't have any 2-year-olds in training here. 3-year-olds is what you asked. Well, so now we have the horses that raced last year at age 2. Now they're just coming around and they're starting to be age 3. There's a smaller group of those horses because they just became 3-year-olds. So there's not a lot of races exclusively for 3-year-olds. If you pick up a program and read the conditions of the race, the races are written almost like a menu at a restaurant. If you're a trainer and you have 20 horses, not all of them are horses that like to run 6 furlongs. Not all of them are colts and geldings. They might be fillies and mares,
sure,
males and females. So the racing secretary at the track has to write races that will hopefully satisfy a trainer who has many horses.
Is there a standard? I mean, again, we're talking about like fillies, mares, geldings, and, you know, being born on, everyone's on January 1st. And like to be a thoroughbred, I think the conception has to be even viewed. It can't just be assumed through in vitro. It like doesn't like the,
right.
There people have to be present to see it.
Live cover is the expression you're trying to get around. Yes. A live cover is mandatory with thoroughbred horse racing. It is not in just about every other discipline. In quarter horse racing, live cover is not mandatory. You can have in vitro. You can have the embryo transfer. My wife is an equine veterinarian, and her specialty is in just that. She works every breeding season because there's a breeding season. You breed in the first part of the year so that they'll have babies as close to January as possible.
Yeah.
So that is what she has done for a living. But they do it with reiners and ropers and cutters and jumpers and dressage horses. It's all permitted except within thoroughbred racing. They do not allow anything but the live cover or the actual live conception.
Gotcha. And as for the names, I know we kind of, Mike and I talked about it in the previous segment of the podcast. There has to be, when it comes to like the official naming of the horses, there's like a reference to the patrilineal side and the matrilineal side of the horse. And then it, does it go to a jockey club? Like sort of.
You are correct and you're incorrect.
Yeah,
so here
okay.
it is. So yes, it must get approved by the jockey club. It is not mandated that it has to be based on the paternal and the maternal side. I prefer that. I like that. I like clever names where they'll take a derivative of the male and female side and come up with a whole new name that doesn't even use some of the, usually, you know, you use some of the same names. Like if the sire was Majestic Prince and the mother was Queen Zenyatta, you might have, you know, Majestic Zenyatta or,
that's
you know,
awesome.
Something that's, but I like some that there's a little more thought into it. But what, where the jockey club comes into play is the name may not be more than 18 characters.
Oh,
and it may not be named after a champion classic horse. Like there'll never be a secretariat that will be approved. And it may not be a lewd name or a controversial name, although some have slipped by
sure.
and have duped the jockey club. And another is after 15 years, they will recycle names. And I know I've been involved in horse racing for over 40 years now, and I've seen a couple, two or three horses resurface. And I said, wait, I remember that horse.
I didn't know that.
And here it comes again. The Amadevil was an outstanding thoroughbred that ran here at in Fawner Park in the 70s. And there's an Amadevil quarter horse, but I don't know that there's another Amadevil thoroughbred. But yeah, there's a number of horses that I've seen in my own time that their names have been duplicated.
Do you have a favorite horse that you've, you know, seen or called at Fawner Park that has stuck with you through the years?
Yeah, at Fawner Park, there was a horse by the name of Honor the Hero who... he did run in the Bossum and he did not win. He was in a very close photo. I just remember he arrived to us from Turf Paradise in Florida. And when he showed up, he looked like he was a different breed. He had that Southwest shine going. He was so healthy and robust looking, and he really did shine. I mean, you could have combed your hair by looking at the sheen that bounced off of him. And he ran in a couple races and he won some here. I think he won the prep race, the Dowd Mile. One of the Bosselman winners was Music Prospector. And I remember how incredible he looked when he turned for home. He looked like a dog at a dog track, just, you know, really leaning into the turn and just rifling by the others. But excuse me, a lot of good memories. And I was calling races in 1990 when that race went from being just the Gus Fawner handicap to the Bosselman Gus Fawner handicap with the addition of $40,000. It became a $100,000 race.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're kind of in a unique time. There's a lot of development, I think, coming to the area with the legalization of gambling. Mm-hmm. What does the future look like for you at Fawner Park? At, you know, with the future of this racetrack, is horse racing going to continue to be a part of the Grand Island community?
It must. And that's, frankly, the only reason why we are engaging with a casino partnership and endeavor here is for two reasons. One, to revitalize the thoroughbred horse racing in Nebraska. And that revitalizes not only the thoroughbred industry, but it also revitalized the ag industry that surrounds it for these farmers to provide for these trainers that have now many more horses, hay, alfalfa, grain, things of that nature. The other is Fawner has, we don't have deep pockets. And so we need our share of the casino revenue to help maintain this 1954 facility. You are seated right now in the Fawner suite. And for your listeners, it back in the 90s, it was a pretty fancy looking place with overstuffed chairs and a bar, and it's ornate with a lot of artifacts. There's a picture of Gus Fawner over there on the wall, and there's a balcony you can step out and watch the races. But it's 2021 right now,
sure.
So the look it looks a little bit like we're on the set of well, the colors are maroon and forest green, and Fraser Crane wore a lot of suits,
yeah,
looking like that. Anyway, so this needs to be re-enhanced. But this is the least. This is on a list of top 20 things I want to do. It's 30 because we're a 1954 car going down the road with 2021 vehicles, and we will never be flush. I've said that before. People can't get their head around it. There's always something that needs to be prepared. Our road grader out here is a 1982 road grader. The loaders to haul the manure, 1984, 1986. And, you know, we just keep them together with spit and string.
Well, I think that's a feeling that Stir Museum can relate to as well sometimes.
Sure.
But that's all the questions I had for you today. Is there anything that you feel like you didn't get to say that you'd rather want to say?
Well, I think the reason why Fawner Park stays alive, and there are dozens of racetracks that have closed of this size or even greater, in the last 40 years since I've been involved in horse racing, is because of the community. The people come here and support this, not only because they enjoy the fun, but they get it. And they'll either support, not maybe just by helping out with some sort of subsidy, or they're a business partner with Fawner Park, and then they purchase a racing sponsorship, or it's just raw interest in wanting to come and have a fun time. Half the people that come here really aren't big thoroughbred race fans. They just like the party.
Sure.
And we welcome that. It's a good time of the year for us to race. And if we can enhance the product that we're presenting because of casino money and just doing the best we can on our own, then we want to do that for the horsemen and the race fans, the citizens of Central Nebraska.
Absolutely. I think we're going to hit pause, leave it there. Stay with us, and we'll be back after these words. And that's going to do it for us here after the first episode of Season 5 of Stir Crazy Podcast. This was a topic I really enjoyed. I'm a big fan of horse racing, and I think I need to do a better job of getting out to more horse races myself at Fawner Park.
Absolutely. I think the excitement and the passion for it really came across in talking with Chris. And yeah, I might need a chart of terminology at the end of that, but I think it'll be pretty good. I do not need a chart for next week's episode, though, because I think it's a issue that a lot of people are familiar with.
Join us again next week for what will be one of two episodes that will feature the topic of prohibition. The first is going to focus on our more local history regarding that topic and Nebraska breweries, etc. And then a week after that, we are going to delve into prohibition on a national stage and really talk about the topic in general.
Yeah, and this is all tied into an event coming up at Stewart in June where we're going to be helping Prairie Pride Brewery, hard word to say, premiere a beer that is a pre-prohibition era recipe. So keep an eye out for that and join us in a week for part one of a podcast on prohibition.
There's going to be a lot of history, a lot of fun, great conversations. Stick around. I think you're going to really enjoy it.